This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Joining us now is Washington State Representative, District 6, Derek Kilmer. And I guess first things first, there is a December 20th deadline for passing the budget bill. You're on the Appropriations Committee. Is there any serious threat of yet another government shutdown?
There shouldn't be. There's no good reason to see the government shut down. I think there's the vast majority of things in the appropriations discussion have been agreed to. I think there's some final negotiation on some final issues. Those last issues, like any negotiation, can be the trickiest, but my sincere hope is that Congress can get to an agreement on a long-term spending deal, and even if it needs an extra day or two, it would hopefully pass a continuing resolution to avert a shutdown.
Let's get to the new trade agreement. Are there any big winners and losers in Washington as a result of the new USMCA?
Well, listen, I think our state does pretty well when we export Washington products all over the world, whether you're talking about Boeing airplanes or Microsoft software or apples and cherries, wood products, delicious almond roca made in Washington 6th Congressional District. We do pretty well. And I've actually been somewhat critical of NAFTA, in part because it's a 25-year-old trade agreement. That agreement has in it the word telegraph, and it doesn't have the word internet. So the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement was an effort to address some of those problems. This is largely now being referred to as kind of NAFTA 3.0, because what we initially got from the Trump administration was NAFTA 2.0, and frankly, it wasn't good enough. It was not good enough from the standpoint of protecting labor standards and environmental standards. It had provisions related to pharmaceuticals that a number of us were concerned about, and there was not sufficient enforcement. And over the course of many months of negotiation, we were able to fix a lot of the problems that needed fixing. And so I think there is a real opportunity to modernize this in a way that's good for workers. You saw the AFL-CIO endorse the agreement because, in contrast to the status quo, this should be better news for not just for employers, but also for working people.
Let's get to impeachment then. You're going to have to vote on the articles of impeachment, probably next week? I mean, that's coming up. So
next week.
Yeah. Have you decided?
I have. The articles of impeachment were introduced. It's not long, and I encourage your listeners to read through it. And it focuses on two areas that I think are really of enormous concern. The first is the abuse of presidential power, and a finding that I think came out clearly in the hearings and has come out clearly in the evidence that the president solicited the interference of a foreign government, asking them to publicly announce investigations to harm the election prospects of his political opponent. And that is an abuse of power. And I think that is largely undebatable that he did that. He says he did that.
But in terms of the actual consequences of what President Trump did here, I've been reading the article in the Washington Post about the Afghanistan papers, which show that we were lied to again and again about what was going on in Afghanistan, that the military knew early on it was a catastrophe, both under Bush and under Obama. And nobody was ever held to account for that, even though it wasted literally $1 trillion and the lives of thousands of American soldiers who, through PTSD or other means, are never going to be the same again. I mean, we didn't impeach anybody for that, and yet now we're talking about the Russian interference in the election, which is bad, and a conversation which is bad, but nothing that rises to that level. I mean, what about that?
Well, I certainly share your concern about the information that's come out about Afghanistan, but I am somewhat surprised to hear you say it's bad, but why does it matter? I think it does matter. And listen, I've heard from people who say, you know, we shouldn't be relitigating the 2016 election. I agree with that. I didn't agree, you know, I didn't vote for the guy, but you know, to me, this is not about relitigating the 2016 election. I've heard some people say, well, why not wait and just allow the 2020 election to play out? To which I would respond, that would be a lot easier if the allegations involved didn't involve trying to influence the outcome of the 2020 election. Mm-hmm. And I've heard some people say, well, you know, this is a very divisive process, and why further divide a country that's far too divided already? And listen, I, as you and I have discussed, I spent a lot of time trying to figure out how do we bring together people? Where do we build bridges where we can? But I think you have to ask yourself, if the information that has come out about withholding security assistance and asking one of our allies to dig up dirt on a political rival to influence the outcome of an election, and the persistent acts of obstructing and withholding information, if that is not enough, the question is, what do you need to see to be willing to pursue articles of impeachment? And I guess, you know, that's the question that will be put before the House next week.
Yeah, understood. Sixth District Congressman Derek Kilmer. Congressman, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You bet. Always good to talk to you.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington. An evergreen playground.
And here he is, our resident historian Felix Spinell, for All Over the Map, a quick look at the stories behind the names of local places. And this week, on the Columbia River, not far from Lake Chelan, there was, once upon a time, a navigation hazard known as the Methow Rapids.
Yeah, this is over by Pateras, which I used to think was pronounced Pateros, but it's actually pronounced Pateras. It's where the Methow River enters the Columbia. And just downriver from there, there used to be the Methow Rapids. And much like the Dalles and the Cascades and Celillo Falls, those other long-gone natural navigation hazards on the Columbia, the Methow Rapids made it tough but not impossible for canoes and steamboats to move up and down the river back in the 19th century and early 20th century, before highways and bridges came along. The first non-native to go down the Methow Rapids was David Thompson, the explorer, who was working for a fur company back then. And then in the 1880s, the Army Corps of Engineers did a survey of the upper Columbia to determine the feasibility of steamboat travel, and their report said this: "The country is strewn with great boulders which extend into the Columbia River, being the principal cause of the Methow Rapids, which here form an impediment to the navigation of the Columbia. These rapids are not bad enough to prevent steamers going up or down, though it is highly probable that during high water, steamers might not be able to ascend without the use of a line." And that means they had a big, like, 3-inch diameter manila rope, and the Army Corps of Engineers put these U-bolts into the rocks. And the steamboat people would attach the rope to that U-bolt.
That seems fairly treacherous.
Yeah, it was not. It was pretty. They would, get the boiler going full speed, and then they use a winch, like a capstan on the deck, to kind of crank themselves upriver, which isn't that practical, right?
No.
But it was, back in those days, what else could you do? In 1907, Hiram Chittenden, who the Ballard Locks are named for, led a team up to the Methow Rapids and blew them up with dynamite. I'm not sure how much they cleared out of the way, but they improved the navigation.
I'm sure they got an environmental impact statement before doing that.
Oh, yeah,
that.
It was voluminous, probably 3 feet thick with documents. Yeah. There was a court case went on, Methow versus Chittenden.
Yeah.
And that steamboat era of the Columbia really only lasted from the 1880s till around the 19-teens or so, but I think the last boat was operating in the 20s, and they built a bridge over near Brewster there. And the rapids went away completely back in the mid-60s when the nearby Wells Dam was built by Douglas County PUD and what's called Lake Pateras, which is essentially a wide part of the Columbia River, was created. And in Pateras, in the little park there, they have a section of one of those old U-bolt rocks that they must have cut out before they built the dam, and they stuck that there in the park. And you pull on the little piece of iron and stuff, and you get the sense of how crazy that must have been to be in a steamboat working your way, like life or death, up the river by winching yourself up the rapids.
Wow. I always thought that lake was named after Jack Patera.
I thought so too, yeah, but it's actually
Pateras.
And Pateras, it's a Philippine word that means duck raiser or shoemaker, because someone who fought in the Spanish-American War in the Philippines loved that and called that area Pateras.
Wow.
Who knew?
Yeah. Thank you, Felix. All of Felix's features are on MyNorthwest.com. The state is going to have another gun debate in the upcoming legislative session. Yesterday, the state attorney general unveiled a package of gun reform bills that he wants to protect. And the reason is, he says, it's essential as a way to prevent mass shootings in Washington. Hannah Scott is here. So what is Attorney General Ferguson talking about?
So he's got a package of three gun safety bills. Two of them are bills that he's been trying to get passed for a few years now, and one we haven't seen before. He says every year, as he does every year when he's announcing his gun safety legislation, he had another fresh example of why these new laws are necessary to protect against mass shootings, this time pointing to the August shooting at a Dayton, Ohio nightclub.
That shooting took 32 seconds. In those 32 seconds, that's all it took for an individual armed with a 100-round magazine and an AR-15 type weapon to shoot 36 people in Dayton. So he killed 9 people and injured 27 in just 32 seconds. Well, how do you do that? Well, you do that by having an AR-15 type weapon and a 100-round double drum magazine. In Washington State, that same weapon and that 100-round double drum magazine are perfectly legal to purchase in our state.
And he says that's a problem, and the reason that he's once again asking for a ban on so-called assault weapons. He points to research from the Violence Policy Center as evidence of the need.
A study analyzing FBI data showed that 20% of the law enforcement officials killed in the line of duty from 1998 to 2001 were killed with assault weapons. Assault weapons are 11 times more likely to be used in a mass shooting than a handgun. When assault weapons or high-capacity magazines are used in mass shooting, more than twice as many people are shot.
And that's why, again, we've got the limits on so-called high-capacity magazines, so nobody would be allowed to have a magazine of 10 rounds or more. More than 10 rounds.
It will save lives. Limiting magazines forces shooters to reload, providing precious seconds for law enforcement to intervene and for victims to escape. During Sandy Hook, for example, 11 children were able to escape while the shooter was forced to reload from his high-capacity magazine. An analysis of mass shootings from 2009 to 2017 revealed that twice as many people die and 14 times as many people are injured when high-capacity magazines are used.
But he can expect plenty of pushback on both of those proposals. Last session, when the magazine limit bill got its hearing, it was an overflow crowd with the NRA and other gun rights groups packing the room with their supporters. And on the issue of these high-capacity magazines, the NRA's Tom Kwisiak told lawmakers that they were getting bad information about these.
It's important, I think, to clarify that these magazines are standard-capacity magazines that come with typical semi-automatic handguns that people use to defend themselves on a day-to-day basis. They make up over half the magazines owned in the United States. They're not high capacity. They're not uncommon.
100 rounds is standard?
No, 10, more than 10.
Oh, more than 10.
Yeah, so that's what the proposal is, to only allow for 10 rounds.
So and what would he accept, did he say?
What would he do?
Yeah, would he accept any limits on the size of magazines for handguns?
They didn't actually dive into that because it was a hearing and no...
I mean, it's undeniable. Yeah. It's a good thing if a bad guy has to stop to reload, right?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, okay. The 100-round drum one, like that was used in Dayton, Ohio, I don't know what possible reason you need that. So.
Right. And I mean, people who already have... The problem is that there's a lot of new research coming out on guns these days, and it's turning out that a lot more of these guys are purchasing their weapons legally. So, I mean, if somebody's already got a 100-round drum or whatever it is they have, as long as he protects it, it's not going to hurt anybody. But if they're openly for sale to anybody who walks in, that would seem to me to be a problem.
I would definitely agree with that. So that's part of the reason on magazines. One of the other proposals that the AG has got right now is a proposal to really require background checks on ammunition sales. Right now, the feds don't allow their federal background check system to be used for ammunition sales. Yeah. So this would be the state passing that law so that when they do, which the AG says could happen if there was a change in president, basically, then we would be able to do that, because you want to make sure that, like violent felons, several other states, 14, I think, have laws that say you can't go buy bullets if you can't go buy guns. We don't have that law, so we're trying to catch up. Those are the various proposals he's got out there.
Yeah, interesting. I say that you have to question somebody who goes in and says, "I want to have a 100-round magazine to hunt." Right? I mean, I don't hunt, but I'm pretty sure that you can have a pretty good time hunting without having a 100-round magazine, right?
I would think so. I don't hunt either. And you know, though, there's those people who are just gun enthusiasts. They want to go out and they like to shoot those kind of things for just, you know, for fun kind of thing. But I don't know how I don't know that you necessarily need it. It's still seen as eroding the Second Amendment rights.
I'm not even doing it because you need it. I mean, I understand it's a lot of fun to go out and shoot, as long as we make sure that the people who are doing that. See, I'd go beyond just a background check. I want to make sure they're of good character or something, right? Because you're entrusting a lot of firepower in the hands of one person. And that's the problem here. It's that when you have the power of one person to basically massacre an entire group of people, you got to be kind of careful about that.
You do have to be kind of careful of that. But also, you've got the Second Amendment, right? And all of that is seen as your right to defend yourself.
The Second Amendment doesn't protect your right to buy a bazooka. I mean, we put limits on that, right? Or a machine gun.
On machine guns, right, yes. And that's as anything else is seen as further erosion, and it's a problem, and it's going to get some pushback. But the AG says he's feeling good about these, at least the high-capacity magazine bill, especially getting through this session. There's a change in leadership with incoming Speaker of the House, Lori Jenkins, who's very strong on gun reform. So.
Hannah Scott, thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
July of 1996, the Olympics came to Atlanta, and so did a terror attack, which was promptly followed by one of the biggest law enforcement screw-ups in American history. Tom Tangney is here with our Friday film review and the Richard Jewell story.
That's right. So an innocent man wrongly accused is inherently dramatic. When the accusation is not only murder, but attempted mass murder, the stakes are even more dramatic. And when this accused man also seems uniquely ill-equipped to defend himself, well, you have the basis for Clint Eastwood's latest movie, Richard Jewell. Richard Jewell was a household name for a few months in 1996 after he discovered a bomb just before it blew up and killed two people and injured 100 others in Atlanta's Centennial Park during the Summer Olympics.
Richard, you're a national hero now.
Thank you, sir. But I was just doing my job.
His national hero status didn't last but a few days when the Atlanta Journal-Constitution broke the story that the FBI was looking at him as their number one suspect. Jewell's life was turned upside down. Hounded by FBI agents and the media, Jewell became a national pariah and a punchline, and he didn't have a clue as to why. Truth be told, Jewell, played brilliantly by little-known actor Paul Walker Hauser, was something of an odd duck. He was an overweight, unmarried, 33-year-old security guard living with his mother, who was played by Kathy Bates, by the way, at the time of the blast. He'd always dreamed of being a police officer, but had been let go from a number of law enforcement jobs, primarily for overzealousness. Jewell so looked up to authority that when the worm turned and the FBI was coming hard after him, his attorney, Watson Bryant, played by Sam Rockwell, could only express his frustration at his client's accommodating behavior.
Stop trying to be their best friend.
I was raised to respect authority.
Authorities are looking to eat you alive.
Get that? I was raised to respect authority. Yeah. Authority is looking to eat you alive. Don't you get it? Richard Jewell, the movie, is a cautionary tale about the devastating personal consequences of a citizen being outed before a criminal investigation is complete. Eastwood is quite clear on who he thinks is to blame for nearly destroying Jewell and his mother's lives. Attorney Watson Bryant, mouthpiece for Eastwood.
His accusers are two of the most powerful forces in the world, the United States government and the media.
That sentiment clearly resonates in the world of 2019 politics, but I'm not sure if that's intentional or accidental. What I do know is that, as rich as its portrayal is of Jewell, his mother, and his lawyer, the movie suffers a bit by the almost cartoonish presentation of its designated villains, the FBI, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and the female reporter who broke the initial story. Objections have been raised especially by the suggestion that the reporter got her big scoop by sleeping with an FBI agent. Since there's no evidence of that, and the reporter is no longer alive to defend herself, it seems an unnecessary slur. It's the worst kind of irony that a movie about a man unfairly portrayed in the media commits the same sin against someone else. Nonetheless, Richard Jewell is a fascinating look at the impact these large societal forces inevitably have on lone individuals. Individuals who find themselves at the center of a storm through no fault of their own. And it's not a pretty sight.
I'm curious, was it, in your opinion, as a professional film critic, was the love scene, the sleeping with the FBI, was that strictly necessary for the film?
Absolutely, it's not necessary. In fact, I think, even at the time, and they don't literally show them sleeping, she makes this suggestion. She has this very strong come on in a bar, and then they go off.
Yeah.
And she says something like, you know, should we go to my place or do it in the car? I mean, it's a very explicit. And at the time, as I'm watching this movie, it took me out of the movie, go, really? Did that? That didn't. And so I had to start doing all this research about that. Yeah. It doesn't even ring true in the movie. The best thing about a good movie, I think, is when the villains seem understandable.
Yeah.
Instead of just sort of, you know, painting metaphoric horns on them, it's certainly not needed. One of the things this movie is based on is like a 60-page article in Atlantic Magazine from 1997. And I read through the entire thing to see, well, is that suggesting that? I said, no, she got a tip from an FBI agent and they went on. And so this movie, yeah, I think, wants to make it more dramatic, but I think it takes away
from
the
dramatic
power.
That's too bad, because I think the movies perform an important function when they correct a wrong. And the wrong here is that a lot of people, as you were pointing out to me, don't realize Richard Jewell was exonerated.
Absolutely.
And so you want to be able to argue that the movie is completely accurate. When you throw in something like this, that sort of spoils it.
I know. It's unnecessary, because the movie is really powerful and strong. The guy who plays Richard Jewell is fantastic. The only other thing that I've ever seen him in is he played one of the goons that broke Nancy Kerrigan's legs in the movie I, Tonya. And
they do look kind of surprisingly a lot. Shane Stant and Richard Jewell.
This is a factual irony, too. Jay Leno made a joke about Richard Jewell when they showed him, and he says, he looks like the kind of guy who would break Nancy Kerrigan's legs. And it's like, oh, my God, the same actors playing both of them. Wow. And both
they
good
do
movies.
Look exactly.
Yeah, I know.
Wow.
So anyway.
How many tangs for Richard Jewell?
I give it 3 tangs out of 4.
Like you tell him.
Sure. He was born to play just those two guys in history.
Right. And he's done it.
It's time for the Daily Dose of Kindness now. In the coffee-crazed culture of the Pacific Northwest, it's not unusual to see espresso stands on each corner of one intersection. They compete every day. But in Oak Grove, Oregon, just south of Portland, all competition was set aside for one day, for one man. Dave McAdams, who owns a stand, called the local with his wife, Tina.
He was diagnosed with cancer for the 3rd time. This time, unfortunately, it was inoperable. Well, unfortunately, he's going to be leaving in a few weeks.
K2TV says he's in hospice now. It's an incredible act of kindness to the owner of the competing coffee stand across the street, stepped aside and stepped inside the local to be their barista for free.
It's supposed to be friendship over business, community over competition. I am here supporting them, trying to generate attention for their business, to help them with medical bills and expenses.
And also to make sure that her competition, the local, stays open even after Dave is gone. And it was their busiest day ever. Tina says it meant the world to them.
I knew he was an impactful man, but I never knew the extent.
And now he does too, which is what any of us would want to know before we say goodbye.
Wonderful thing to do. Time for our Sports Insider, Stacy Rost, who is part of Tom, Jake, and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. And you got to talk with Russell Wilson. The whole thing's on MyNorthWest.com. And the part I heard, that was the best interview, the most content-enhanced interview with Russell Wilson I've heard, because usually he talks like a politician. But here's a clip of what your interview had.
Yeah, I think the first thing is you go to the truth. Okay, well, what was the truth of the game? The truth is we didn't make as many plays as we wanted to. I keep it at that. You know, when I go into this next game, I don't ever think about the past one. I think about, okay, this is what we got to do in this one.
You seem to be saying you guys in the in sports radio business just analyze too much. He likes to keep it simple.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what you have to do also when you're a player, right? It's kind of what both jobs have to do to succeed. In order to succeed, we have to analyze it, not only because it's fun for us as people who love sports to kind of dissect things and try to figure out what went wrong and have debates, because that's what those conversations spark. If you're a player, though, you're not going to get very far by trying to figure it out with all of this kind of, and this isn't him knocking analytics, but if you're too in your own head, you're not going to get very far. So I think what he's saying is I narrow it down to, for instance, I threw a ball to DK Metcalf and there was a drop or there was an incompletion. That's what happened. Yeah. Let's go back and look at what we need to fix about that instead of putting too much into it when we're on the field. Because when you're on the field, that's what matters.
What I heard in that interview was a man who he's focused on controlling his thoughts, because if you don't do that, they run away and distract you from the job at hand. Is that a fair interpretation?
Yeah, that's exactly what it was about. I mean, we had questions about like MVP and stuff, which we still got to, how to move on from the loss. But the majority of the conversation ended up coming back to just how you control your mindset in a game, in part because he's so passionate about that. And he talked about working on that specifically with his own kind of professional that he works with for that. And then just kind of preaching that throughout his career. And you wonder how much of that, I tend to think quite a bit, but you wonder how much of that is attributed to when a play breaks down and he's one of the best players under pressure, or he's one of the best players in kind of a broken play. It's probably because you can just kind of stay calm and keep cool. Same with fourth quarter drives, right? So much of that's important.
What's the newest thing you learned about Russell Wilson in your conversation with him?
Oh, man. I think it was more of a demeanor thing. It wasn't a fact, because I feel like the job is knowing everything there is to know with just kind of basic stuff and facts and information about players. It was seeing a new side to his demeanor. So I hadn't actually been in an interview with him where he was a much more kind of natural person. And part of that's because I'm a reporter. And I think Jake put it best when he was like, you know, there's more consequences to being real and being yourself than there are benefits, because you might say something that you didn't mean and then it gets spun. And so the best thing to do is just to be a consummate professional, which is what Russell Wilson's been doing his entire life. I'm talking about like back when he was a kid and his dad used to help train him how to like do press conferences and how he would be professional and present yourself.
I didn't know that.
So, well, his dad was a former athlete. So it was, I think it was something that Russell Wilson clearly has always been very serious about. And, but he and Jake actually know each other pretty well. They have a really good relationship personally and professionally. They work together for his own quarterback academy. They train together. So it was so interesting to see a side of him when he's with someone he knows and I think trusts versus, you know, people that he has a lot of respect for in the media, but you want to be very careful with what you say.
But the whole idea of being able to control your mind during a crisis can be applicable in so many things. I think just driving to work, for example, controlling road rage. What do you do when you're stuck in traffic on a morning like this and late for an appointment? You suddenly start running through all these scenarios in your mind instead of focusing, okay, traffic is slow. Here I am. I will get there eventually and keep it simple. And you know, you preach that a lot, but it's different coming from someone like Russell Wilson, who you can see practicing it on the field in the kind of pressure that most of us would only experience in a nightmare. You know what I mean?
That's the thing. And it's like, I'm sure that same mindset would work for, say, like a first responder, even just a way to calm yourself in an incredibly high pressure scenario. But it could even be for little things. And we had his kind of mental trainer Trevor Moad on a couple weeks ago, and he actually said exactly what you did, Dave, which is anyone could use this. This could just be a way to keep yourself calm in any situation. So road rage would be a great example, or it could be with a high pressure job, right? So it was fascinating,
and that's the reason they're going to be Carolina on Sunday.
There you go.
Stacy Rost, our sports insider, you're giving the prediction, by the way.
Oh, man. I think they're going to get pretty far ahead. I'm going to say 30 Seahawks and 14 Carolina.
30 to 14. There it is. Scoring. We've locked it down. Thank you, Stacy.
Thanks.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. And it's time to Ask Allie. Allie Sokolow, licensed mental health counselor, brought to you by Pro Club, the Northwest Premier Center for Health and Wellness. And today we have a very sensitive topic. It's about asking, I guess it'd be your son or daughter, when are you planning to make me a grandfather or a grandmother? First of all, should you even ask that question?
Absolutely not. And I think that it goes beyond even potential grandparents. I think that the second you start dating someone at a certain age, people want to know when you're getting engaged. The second you get engaged, they want to know when the wedding is. And the second the wedding's over, they want to know when the baby's coming.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really nobody's business. However, we can say that all day, but people are still going to ask.
That's right, because they think it's an innocent question.
They do think it's an innocent question, and it's being curious about their lives, right?
Right. I do remember my mom sort of mentioning, boy, it'd be nice to be a grandmother. I mean, we eventually obliged, but not because of her request. I mean, it was because when we were ready. And I was expecting that question.
Yeah.
But, you know, it didn't bother me.
And I don't know, so you can tell me if I'm wrong, but I would say that you probably weren't bothered by that question because you weren't sensitive about having babies or not having babies. You were secure in the fact that you would have babies when you're ready.
I knew we wanted children.
Yes,
but I knew we wanted to be ready. I mean, we wanted to have a stable job,
want
a place to live, you know, that kind of thing. So how do you handle if you're on the receiving end of that question? Mm-hmm. You want to be polite. You don't want to snap at your parents, but
right.
Or whoever's asking the question.
Right. So there's a couple of things. One is be very aware of your reaction. And if you're feeling insecure, if you've had trouble getting pregnant, if you've had trouble keeping a baby, having any sort of fertility issues, this is going to raise the hair on the back of your neck.
That's true.
Yeah. Remember that people are coming from a place of good typically when they ask those questions, and respond any way you feel comfortable. You know, I think a good go-to is, we're still talking about it. I think that if you have decided you don't want to have kids, but you're worried about people's reactions, reasons, it's really important to be clear with yourself about that. And you can say, you know, we've decided we're not going to have kids.
So that's okay just to say.
That is okay.
That would shut it down.
That would shut it down. And if somebody keeps pushing, then it's okay for you to say, you know, it's kind of hard for me to talk about. And I don't want to keep having this discussion.
And that is the other thing to consider. Especially if you're like a friend outside the family asking the question, to understand that it could be that the couple is having trouble having kids, and it is a sensitive topic, and it isn't just being seen as an innocent question.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think that we have done a good job over time learning that it's never okay to ask somebody if they're pregnant or not, mm-hmm. right? And so I think the next step of that
especially if they make a mistake.
Uh-huh. That can go very badly.
<That's right. laughs>
And so I think people are very aware of that, and so I hope that people can start to learn that it's not okay actually to ask when people are having kids too, because sometimes people are really struggling. Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you this, taking from the other point of view now. There are some people whose curiosity is insatiable.
Uh-huh.
They simply have to know. Is there an indirect way of finding out?
If they're having kids or not?
Yeah.
Yeah, you can say, so you're buying a house. How many bedrooms does that have?
Oh, that's very clever.
Yeah, you can be very indirect about it. I actually think that's more polite than being direct.
Yeah?
Yeah, in this situation, I don't give that advice often. Yeah.
Is your new house in a good school district?
That's right.
How's that one?
Where do those neighbor kids go to elementary school?
Yeah, I wonder. Well, but the school district thing is a legitimate question because it directly affects the value.
That's a good point.
Potential for appreciation of the home.
That's a really good point.
So really,
point,
you're
actually.
That's a more of a financial question.
Absolutely.
Are you having kids question?
You are a smart dad, I think.
Yeah. I should never have said this publicly.
That's right. You just ruined it for yourself.
Yeah, I know. Okay, so that's good to keep in mind. What you're saying is, yes, we know you're curious.
Yes.
But understand that for some young couples, that's a sensitive area.
Yeah, here's the deal. Here's my advice to people who are curious. Don't ask. And if you're a person who is feeling insecure about their decision around having kids, it's okay for you to have an internal bad reaction to that question, but just have the awareness to know that people are not... they don't have malintent when they ask you about it.
Allie Sokolow, Ask Allie. Thank you, Allie.
Thank you.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.